100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. When it comes to optics, I get the same question over and over again. What are the best all-around binoculars? Well, it's tough to find something that works in every condition great, but after using a pair of Maven B1.2 10x42s, I think I found them. They feature an 8x or a 10x option, superior low light performance, tack sharp edge-to-edge clarity, a generous depth of field, and a silky focus mechanism. All of Maven Optics have a lifetime no-fault warranty and hail from the great state of Wyoming. I've been using Maven Optics since I bought my first pair in 2017, and I think you should test them out for yourself. Head over to mavenbelt.com and use the code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift with any full-price optics order. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top. And then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com. If you've wanted that hunting camp tradition that we talk about, that experience, but you don't have a hunting camp of your own, you're welcome to come stay at my hunting camp up here in the Pennsylvania Wilds called the Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds. So if you go over to Airbnb, you can check out our three-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath house that's right in the heart of Pennsylvania elk country. It's only minutes away from a bunch of public land to be able to hunt, hiking trails, outdoor recreation, fishing, all of those things there. The house is completely fully stocked with everything that you need to be able to spend a week hunting deer, taking your family up to see the elk, anything like that. So if you head over to Airbnb and search Elk Crossing Getaway in the PA Wilds, you'll find my listing there and you can rent out my house. Send us a message, an inquiry that you're interested in it and mention that you heard it on the podcast here, then we'll get you 10% off of your first stay.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, what is up? Welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt Podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by Michael Perry of Alabama. He currently holds the Alabama state record for his 195-inch mountain buck, has killed over 40 public land bucks, 8 points or better, and is the author of Secrets to Taking Mature Bucks on Public Land. We discuss Michael's approach to finding big mountain bucks in rugged terrain, creating hunt plans, using annual data, trail cameras, the story of hunting the state record non-typical buck, and really anything else hunting mountain whitetails. I think that you'll get a lot out of this one, as Michael's been doing it for a long time in Alabama on public land and just continues to get it done. So I've been looking forward to this one for a while after I read his book, and I think you will like that too. on this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have a story coming from Gage Royer out of Pennsylvania. Gage wrote in, "I shot this buck the first Tuesday of rifle season on public land in the Pennsylvania mountains. We did a little scouting in bear season and saw a few good bucks, but mostly went in blind. My dad has hunted on this land since high school, but hasn't hunted there for 10 years. I shot him around 10 o'clock in the morning, and he ended up grossing 156 3/8 inches. Well, congratulations, Gage, because that to shoot a 150 in Pennsylvania is pretty wild. They're out there, that's for sure, but definitely not easy to be able to do. So congratulations. And if everyone wants to check out this buck, head over to Instagram at East Meets West Hunt or Facebook East Meets West Outdoors. Check out the photo of Gage's giant mountain buck. And I really love the photo that he has there, because so it has his camp in the background, and it's just a perfect Pennsylvania tradition looking photo there. So thanks for submitting that, Gage. And if you have a mountain buck story you want to submit, send it to my email, beau@eastmeetswesthunt.com, or you could just go over to the website and the contact us form, submit it there. And love being able to go through all these and be able to share it with all of you. In other news, so Riding Mountain Waves, the elk hunting film, just released on Sunday. So if you haven't checked it out yet, part one is out there on my YouTube channel, which is just Beau Martonic. Head over there, check it out. And part two will come out this upcoming Sunday. I'm really excited about this one, because this film is a project. I mean, it was a 21-day hunt. Longest I've ever spent on a single hunt. And I really shows the highs, the lows, everything that goes with it. I threw everything out there as you see it, is how it happened. There was no hiding anything there. So I think hopefully there'll be some valuable lessons learned, and get to see some big elk on camera. So check that out. And also, you may notice with this podcast episode and with everything else going forward, I have new branding. So new logos that are kind of going out. And the original Compass logo that I've had was something that I designed back in 2018 or 2017. I think I might've designed it. I did it myself. I really liked the way it turned out, but it was a little bit complicated, and I wanted to keep that compass angle of it and keep kind of the mountains in it, and with the whole understanding of just finding adventure wherever you go in hunting. But I want to simplify it a little bit. So Jordan Riley over at Captured Creative did an excellent job with branding, with changing the logo up and changing the whole brand feel. So you'll be able to see that. And so I got I'll be having some new apparel coming in here at some point. I did discount some of the other products. That old logo is not going away. It'll be a legacy piece there. I still really like that logo, but figured I'd give a little bit of a discount, clear out some inventory to bring in some new hats. So if you want to go check out some of the sale items at eastmeetswesthunt.com/shop, you can check all of that out. And lastly, I have an idea in my head, and I haven't completely worked it out yet. But in the past, you may have remembered when I have done some Mountain Buck Monday podcasts, where I would do a short 10 to 15 minute podcast on a specific topic and kind of roll that out. So I'm thinking of doing that again during hunting season, but also a thought came to my mind. I listen to some other podcasts outside of the hunting space, and I really like when they do these Q&A podcasts that might be short, you know, 15 to 30 minutes long, sometimes shorter, sometimes a little bit longer. But basically, I get the topics from you guys. So they're question and answer, you know, Q&A type things. You send in some questions, and I pick, you know, two or three of them per episode and just answer them, whether it's just me or maybe I have someone with me to answer them. But I think I want to do that as an additional podcast during hunting season, at least for now. And it would be an audio only podcast. So I've been wanting to do this for a while again, but with now doing the video standpoint, it just takes so much extra time and resources to be able to do the video side of it. I was like, well, why don't I just do the audio version so I could still put the information out there and add some value? But I'm interested to hear your thoughts. And if you do have questions for it, I think the way I'll take the submissions is you send me an email, bodeastmeetswesthunt.com, and just have it in the title Q&A, so I know where it is and I can keep track of all the questions and everything there. Or leave a comment on one of the YouTube videos if you're one of the people that like to look at the video podcast or watch the video podcast a little bit more. So I think I'm gonna roll out with that. Sorry for being kind of all over the place with it. I literally had thought about it right before I was recording this intro, and I was like, you know what? I just need to hold myself to the fire and do it. So this is my way of doing that. But with that being said, I really hope you enjoy this podcast with Michael Perry. And if you like his book, I have a link down below in the show notes to Amazon where you can pick up his book. Really recommend it. A lot of cool stories in there. And until then, we will see you next week. Okay, I think we are rolling. Michael Perry, yeah, welcome to the podcast.
Damn, thanks for having me on. How you doing?
I'm good, good. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm trying to get used to glasses. I had to get glasses, and then that's kind of hard to get used to, but I'm working on it. So.
I went the opposite way. I went away from glasses. I had LASIK eye surgery done about 8 years ago now, and it was the best thing I ever did.
Well, I don't know if LASIK could work on that, on having that reading glasses. You know, I have to have reading glasses real bad. I said, I'm tired of trying to hunt for them, so I want something thick, right, to wear it all the time. So I went that route, and they said my eyes are pretty good everywhere else. They might have done a little bit of adjustment, but it's still something you got to work through to get used to it. So,
yeah. Does that affect your shooting or anything? Like, is that something to get used to?
Today when I shot my bow, I didn't even put my glasses on. So I've not tried anything with a rifle yet, so we'll find out. So if I can just I don't really worry about that as much because you can adjust that focus, on the rifle scope, and then, yep, take care of that, because I don't really want to have to worry about my glasses fogging. So I've heard so many horror stories about that. So if I can get around it without doing that, I'll just keep some readers in my pocket if I need them for something, then hunt without them. So
yeah, just keep the small ones and like those little ones. Like my dad carries these ones in his pocket, so when he's looking at his phone or whatever, he can pull them out. And they just sit on his nose, and then doesn't need them for shooting or doing anything there. Yeah, or just do that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. I shot my bow at 30 yards without it, so I didn't know. I've had a pretty good group, so I might not even worry about using glasses doing that. So, like I say, the biggest part, especially with readers and bow hunting, it makes it tough. I had to changed my complete setup last year. I grew up shooting fingers and instinct. So I always, when I went back to using sights and the release, I always put the vein in the corner of my mouth. So, well, I was having problems when I started needing reading glasses, getting everything kind of lined up through the peep, the pin and focusing on animal or target. So I redone everything last year and got a nose button and just completely changed my style of shooting. And it's helped a lot. So that's I'm glad, because I was worried, like, man, I might have to get a dang crossbow or something. So a bow to me is either to shoot freehanded than a dang crossbow. So
yeah, no. The crossbows are heavy as far as trying to pick it up and shoot it freehanded like that.
Yeah, they're a lot harder than a gun shoot freehanded to me. So
yeah,
if you're not propped, it could be an issue. So
yeah, no, that makes sense. And how long have you been hunting with a bow?
I started later in life. When I was young, my dad was real big into it, and I just played around shooting. But when I got out of the Navy, say at 22, I gun hunted for 3 or 4 years. My brother, he was a bow hunter, and he would harass me, and I finally broke down. So you could say 20-something years. So.
Okay.
Probably about 30 years now, maybe. So I couldn't tell you exactly, but I enjoy it, as probably, I guess, more. I like muzzleloader hunting too, but I actually like all of it. But the bow hunt is, when you accomplish keeping something with a bow, especially a good buck, because you got to get tight quarters. There's no better feeling. So I really love that.
Yeah. You know, it's funny when I was younger and I first started bow hunting, it was like, that's all I wanted to do. I didn't want to hunt with anything else. And then as I've come along later, I just realized that I'm an equal opportunity hunter and whatever season allows me to weapon to use. I mean, last year I started using a muzzleloader, which I've never used one of those before, but they had a January muzzleloader season in Ohio. So I was like, figured I would try that out. And I've used flintlock. I've used flintlock muzzleloaders before in Pennsylvania. Wow. And, but rifle hunting, archery hunting, it's all fun to me. It's all just a little bit different and kind of how you approach it.
Right. Yeah. On the public land that we hunt, you know, when gun season starts, they have specific gun days. So you can bow hunt if you want to, but I'm not going to sit out there with a bow and everybody else got a gun. So,
no.
So that's, I'm going to try to be fair to me. So. And then, yeah. them deer, once the pressure gets on, it's hard to get them close, with a bow, and then they're always edgy. So once yeah. their guns start.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it's so, before we get too far into this, I'd ran into you, I'd met you in person, Mike, down in, not in Alabama, that's where you're from. I met you at the NWTF show. I was working at the Spartan Forge booth and you'd come up and you were looking at some of the maps and going through. And I was like, I recognize this guy. And we started talking and then I realized you introduced yourself and I was like, oh man, I'm really a big fan of, I've listened to you on the Southern Outdoorsman podcast before. And I've, seen a bunch of your stuff and your bucks over the years and I had a lot of respect for you. And you'd given me a copy of your book there to read. So I was excited and, to get to read your book and have spent time. I have it right here in front of me. So Secrets to Taking Mature Bucks on Public Land. And when did that come out? Was that last year?
Last year. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was probably, August or September or something, maybe. So
okay.
I tried to get it out before the, before summer got too carried away, but it was tough. That's a lot of work and different involvements, other people to get that set up. So it's surprisingly how long, I guess it might've been kind of fast compared to what a lot of people said, but it seemed like to me it took forever. So,
yeah. Well, and it was funny when I was reading it and I told you this on the side, one of my favorite things is how it wasn't just a tactic book of just going through, specific tactics. There's always stories that led into, and then you talked about the tactics that led into it. And that's, I like, from an interviewing style with the podcast, doing those types of things, because I learn better from stories than I would to you just to say, I do this, this, and this, and this is my result. It's easier when you kind of, paint a picture of what something looked like and how it played out to be able to find it. And you had said in the beginning of your book that your family's been hunting public land in Alabama for over 50 years, and you yourself, and this number has probably changed since you've written a book last year, but 38 public land bucks, 8 points or better, and your biggest being the Alabama state record at 195 and 6/8.
196 and 3/8. That's another thing about the book. We had some, when Buckmaster scored that, the paperwork was still going through and we had a miss ad on it. So 196 and 3/8, the book's kind of not exactly right. So, but the new book should be right. I had to get that updated, but yeah, it's 196, 3/8, the muzzleloader state record, non-typical. So that's that's a pretty cool accomplishment, So.
Yeah, no, I'd say that's an accomplishment. So how, I want to hear just to kind of give everyone a little bit of a background on you, because again, this is one part of the book I really liked is kind of and reminded me of my family in Pennsylvania, that you grew up in a family of hunters that were, beating it in these mountains on public lands in Alabama. So just give a little background on that.
Yeah. The youngest I can remember, I was living in a city. We lived in a city called Hartsel, and my dad and them, to start out with, they started out duck hunting, then they went to rabbit hunting. They had dogs, and then they started deer hunting a little bit. Well, trapping had some kind of like an explosion. You could make money on it. My dad picked that up, and he was carrying me with him trapping. And I said, well, I want some traps. And I was like bicycle age. I was maybe 11 or 12. And he fixed me up 3 or 4 traps and, kind of jokingly and had me a a stick to take care of whatever I caught, and just kind of put me off. So I took off on my bicycle, headed out till I got out around some pasture lands and trees and stuff. And I started walking creeks, and I found me some raccoon tracks, and I started setting traps. Well, the next day, I caught this big old boar coon. The first thing trap I got to, and you're talking about excited, and the stick my dad had fixed me up, he didn't really fix it, intended me to take care of something with it, so that raccoon tore that stick up in about 30 seconds. So we went round and round in this creek, both of us soaking wet before one of us finally won, and I had that raccoon on that bicycle going back just grinning, and my dad could not believe that I caught some. So that set the initial fire for me to doing the outdoor stuff. Then after that, we started more deer hunting. Then when I turned 17, I hadn't killed a deer yet, but I'd been, you know, quite a bit with my dad. But I joined the Navy at 17 and stayed in there 5 years. And it took me a little while to get back into hunting. And then I didn't kill my first deer until I was 20-something. I didn't kill my first good buck until I was 31. And then you can read the story about that in the book. That started changing my mindset about how I wanted to hunt, what I wanted to go after. My brother killed his whopper buck too, and that changed a lot of thought processes. So, and it's more, you know, the challenge, like in trapping, the challenge of making an animal put its foot on a 1-inch piece of steel in 100 acres or 1,000 acres or whatever land you're, you know, trapping on, is kind of like, you can use that like toward buck, concentrating on a buck, trying to make a buck or get a buck positioned close enough for you to shoot it with a bow or whatever weapon you're using is so cool of a challenge. And that's really what I love doing now is more of a, you know, mature buck, you know, not really a trophy buck, but say a 3.5-year-old older on public land in Alabama. Just that challenge of finding them and kind of trying to be strategic and get close enough to them to take them and get them there to daylight. So
yeah,
that's really just set the fire. But it's been a long process. You know, like I say, I'm 58 years old, and, you know, like I said, 30-something, 8 points or better, you know, 120-something deer total. But, you know, it's not too bad for what I do, but, you know, now things are starting to change a little bit where, you know, if you can buy, I'm starting to play with it a little bit to go to some other states and kind of broaden that horizon. You know, we're a 3-buck state, so where a lot of states are just one, and I don't know how many states you go to, but a lot of people are like picking out 4 or 5 states and trying to spread out on the rut. And then Alabama, we're pretty much just chasing the rut. We have a rut scattered from November to all the way to February, so you can do that. So it's a fun outdoor event. My wife's real big, you know, going with me, and she loves it. So we keep it as a family thing and have a camper and go out, hit some in public campgrounds and set up and spend the meaning. I'll drive to work and go work out of the camper, you know, so and yeah, come back and hunt. So just really enjoy it. Just trying to have a good family time and enjoy the outdoors.
Yeah, and the thing that you referred to about trapping is so interesting to me, because that was something that my dad and his brothers and my grandfathers were really big into trapping, and then it kind of fell off when, you know, fur prices took a huge dive and they don't trap anymore, and I never really learned it, and I really wish that I would have, because I mean, my dad says the same thing about, like, that's, and my grandfather about, like, how much that's helped with deer hunting and learning from trapping.
Yeah, to actually, like, if you were a trapping, say a beginner trapper, whatever, but to really set yourself as an accomplished trapper or a what you would consider a good trapper is to catch an animal without any kind of scent. You know, you trying to figure out how his movements are exactly and put that trap exactly where you think he's going to put his foot and catch him. And when you could figure out doing stuff like that, that really helps your woodsmanship about how animals use things, whether, you know, coyotes are one of the hardest things they are to catch. And we didn't even have coyotes for a long time. They started, you know, populating pretty good here. And I love doing land trapping, trying to catch coyotes, because they were more of a challenge. And figuring that out, that really helped, you know, about how, you know, dirt animals are more of a elusive animal. So the dang coyote can smell and figure stuff out, and they're generally running more than one in a group, and they can figure out stuff pretty quick, and it makes them hard to catch more than one out of a pack. So, but that, I mean, it's just an extreme challenge, and I just love doing that.
Yeah, and so when you started, you know, trapping and getting into deer hunting, did you start out by hunting some of the, like the rugged big woods type areas in Alabama? Is that where you kind of cut your teeth, or is that what you kind of came to later in life?
We spread out. Like my dad and them, real, like you're talking about that muzzleloader hunt. To kill a deer, that was the easiest thing to do, was to carry a muzzleloader, and they followed in muzzleloader hunts, and that was either sex. And most of your gun hunts was buck only. So they, every time they, you know, they all worked at plants, and all his buddies worked at chemical plants and stuff. So they was off, you know, every other weekend or something. So whenever they went them weekend hunts on their mountain areas, if I could find one that was a plant lock hunt or a muzzleloader hunt, that's where we were going. So we're just deer hunting. So, and the rugged part, the mountainous area, we actually got two or three places like it. That's wherever they went, that's where I was going from. So I went and learned from swamps to hills to cut over stuff and, you know, the hilly stuff. But the more mountainous big woods area is what I concentrate on now earlier, because it's the least populated area that's got, you know, the least amount of deer in the state. And it's harder, but it's got the bigger bucks to me, the best chance of a bigger buck. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that you know that pretty well, with having the non-typical state record buck that, you know, came out of one of those types of areas. And I had heard you say that, or read it multiple times in the book, as far as like you look for some of the most rugged, just kind of baddest places to find some of these deer. Do you find a correlation in that?
I think, you know, to get, and we're a big buck, especially in this area that we hunt, he finds the roughest place more like a mountain goat would, you know, just something that he's got the whole a visual advantage and got a couple ways to escape without anybody even seeing him. So the roughest, nastiest place I can find, it don't have to be real far from the road, but it's just what I'm kind of keying on. You know, I always start out, you know, everybody I talk to, and they say, how you start out? So I always start out looking for tracks, you know, walking drainages, you know, rough stuff, especially after rains, you know. And especially right after season, when you can, you know, the leaves are done wore down good and you can find tracks easier, and then look at your maps or topo and trying to figure out what he's doing or backtracking. So, and you know, the nastier, like a lot of times they'll be in the upper thirds or some hills, but that depends on what kind of, you know, food or forage you got or browse, you know, that depends on how rough the winter was or if you had a drought before the frost. That might make them move lower, so you just got to be able to adjust. But nastier, bouldery, just blowdowns, crazy stuff that you can't hardly get through without, you know, making a bunch of noise. They love getting in that and getting on a visual spot where they can see somebody coming.
Yeah, and I like what you said there. As far as, it sounds like you when you find an area you want to go into, you walk the drainages, you walk the bottoms, and check the creek crossings. As far as for big tracks, and that kind of gives you a starting point.
Right. Even the drainages, just walk them all the way up, you know, as high as you can go. Because a lot of times they'll stay higher, and, you know, crossing. So it might be a unique spot. I mean, you're just looking for one big track. Then once you find that track, wherever it's at, you know, look at the terrain around you and try to figure out why that track was there. You know, ask about three or four questions. Well, why is that track pointed this way? You know, why is it, you know, up high, or why is it up low? Why is it by a cutover? Why is it by a pine thicket, or, you know, whatever? So ask a bunch of questions and start and think, if you're the deer, why would you be doing that? And especially at that time of year. So.
Yeah. How did you find the bench buck, which is what you called your 196 3/8 inch deer? How did you find him originally?
Post-season scouting. Every year, as soon as the season's over with, as soon as I got days off, me and my wife or me and buddies, whatever, we'll take off and walk like the areas I've already know about, and then walk some new areas. I'll take off, start walking, and I'll take trail cameras with me and put them out, and where I find a big track, like in a pinch or an edge, you know, and most of the time I'm looking for a place that I can hunt, you know, because I really, you know, I'm getting data is one thing, but getting data on a place where you can actually get there and hunt, making sure I got access, then put a camera up, and I won't check it till the next year and see what comes through. Well, I had a camera picture of him in daylight, probably about 4.5 years old, in November, and I had a couple of them in February, and he looked pretty rough. He had all the stickers and stuff. He was real skinny and was still carrying his antlers. And boy, I thought, man, he'd be a nice one if he lives. And I showed a picture to the biologist. And so I kind of set up for him next year, hoping he'd be alive. And I'd missed him by one day. He'd come by the day after I hunted, following three does at 9 o'clock in the morning. His body would got built back good, but he probably may have been 116th deer, which I would have put the try to kill him anyway. But he didn't have all the stickers. He had one or two splits. But the next year, which I didn't know about it, I didn't know I had any pictures of him until after I killed him. But I still waited till that time that I had him in daylight. The camera proved or showed me that he wasn't daylight until the first week of November. So the first day I was off was November 5th on the last day of the muzzleloader hunt. I went down there and about 9:30.
Have you ever wanted to have Levi Morgan, Andy May, Johnny Stewart, and others available at all times? Well, you can with Cyber Scout from Spartan Forge. Cyber Scout is like the ChatGPT for outdoors men and women. You can ask it any questions related to bow building, scouting, hunting, survival, and a whole lot more. I think you'll be impressed with how it responds. Cyber Scout is currently out now for a select group of early beta testers and will be available to the rest of you really soon. The entire app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery mapping, journaling, deer prediction, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade short barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
A 6 or 7 point that's a pretty good size buck. Most people with a muzzleloader would have shot him. He'd come by a bow range, 20 yards, and just slip around eating wild oats. And up on this, the bench was above a creek crossing in between a bluff gap that goes to a blowdown bedding area. And that's one thing like I do that I kind of left out is I try to put multiple things together from a big picture of why they're crossing there, and that just like I said, he was coming across a creek crossing using this bench that was thick, going to a bluff gap, going to a point that had a bunch of blowdown, just nasty stuff that's kind of hidden. Well, anybody out that 6 or 7 point come easing by, and then about 15 minutes later, I had something catch the corner of my eye, and I could just see his huge side right when it stepped behind some big old like Calcutta bushes or this big old leafy bush tree, and just all I could see was the rear end. He stood back there forever, and I got positioned, and it took him, it seemed like 5 minutes, but it probably wasn't 30 seconds for him to ease out. And I shot, had a quick crosshair behind his shoulder and squeezed. And I could see him mule kick and took off. And if I don't see him die or hear him die, I'll wait an hour. So it took him a little while. I was getting nervous, but anyway, I gathered my stuff up. I had to pee a little bit or something, and then end up knocking the dang bottle off, making a bunch of racket about 30 minutes after I'd shot. And, well, if I already made enough noise, I just went to eat down there and see if I found blood. Anyway, I snuck down, couldn't find blood where I thought I shot at. I was off about 30 yards and started doing a little bit of grid stuff. And then I found it and tracked it to, good blood. Tracked it where he run into a tree, and he knocked bark off of that gum wild oak tree. Just, you could see tine marks in the tree. I was like, golly. Then about 30 yards past that, I could see a deer laying, turned back facing me. And I could see that side that had all them, that hand sticker on it, and then tears started coming down because you could just tell he was a huge deer laying there, and it just, getting up there looking at him and knew that it was the one I'd had on camera. And I've had been running cameras off and on for, back when they had film cameras, and that's the biggest deer I've ever killed I had on camera. It's only like the third or fourth deer that I've killed that I've ever had on camera. Most of the time I've killed a different deer. So But I was so, to accomplish that. And kind of another thing was I wanted to kill him with a muzzleloader because I'd already killed a record butt one with a bow and a record butt one with a rifle in the same piece of public land. And I thought, I don't know of anybody else that would have killed three different weapons with him in the record butt. And I told everybody, I'm going to try to kill him that muzzleloader. And I told that muzzleloader the whole season anyway, even after I killed him, and I killed another a 10 point. But I just, that's what I wanted to do. And it worked out just perfect on the first time that I went down there, and I couldn't believe that. And that just, all the years of trying to get a big buck, because we just didn't have them for a long time. And everybody's killing, I've killed a bunch of spikes and other deer in my career. So I'm just trying to learn to hunt. So, but whenever that, all that coming into play, I just couldn't believe it. Just tore up and just amazed that a deer could get that big, live that long on public land. It's, pretty heavily pressured. It's just amazing. And I was able to, put it together in daylight, because I've had them on camera. We had one we had on camera that we knew was 7.5 years old, and we'd never seen the sucker ever. And we would get daylight pictures of him every year, and he'd always knew us better than we knew him, I guess, because we'd never seen him, and he just disappeared, died, I guess. But it's just so hard to get a deer past 4.5 years old in daylight on public land, especially down here. I mean, it's nearly impossible. They just learn so much. They learn by smell, sight, and hear so much stuff in that 4 or 5 years that they just know you better than them most of the time, because they're nocturnal. I'm sure they get out there and they lay there and say, all right, everybody, it's night time. I can go around and see who all is coming to my area, know where they're coming from, then stage myself where I can wait on them when the season gets here, and then just make, just play with them, have fun with them, just make them think they're going to get me, but they ain't, because I know them better than they know me. So,
yeah.
to do that, it just makes you feel good, because it's tough. The South is, to me, a little bit harder than the North, because our deer, especially our mature bucks, once they get their bodies up, they don't have to eat, in the daylight like a northern deer. They don't get that cold. So once they get their bodies up, they just lay up at night, or till night, and then they can gather up, graze a little bit, and swallow a bunch of acorns whole, and then go bed up and bring them up, regurgitate them all day and eat. So we're up north, when it gets cold, they got to maintain their body heat itself, so they got to eat a bit more than ours do. So it's just so hard to make them get up in daylight. A doe might bring them, or somebody might kick one up. And it's tough.
Yeah, and so that was, when you shot that buck, was that during the rut?
No, it was a pre-rut, pretty much. It was November 5th. Most of the time, they've had early conceptions date like November 13th in this area. But most of the time, the extreme action is be like around Thanksgiving to the first week of December. And I kind of think that is like the initial rut is more like a lull. They get with the initial does, you don't hardly see much unless you're right there where they're at. But it was pretty much pre-rut.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I wasn't sure as far as I know how Alabama has so many different ruts. So I knew you said November, but I wasn't sure if that was the rut or not. But no, that did you have pictures of them that year that you killed them? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I had a camera right there in that general area where I shot him at, and I had another camera like a quarter mile away, and that camera was the only daylight picture of him I had of him. It was in September. I had a couple more nighttime pictures of him, and he actually come by that camera that day, but he was below it. That 6 or 7 point, I got him on camera. I had a picture of him when he come by, but that big buck stayed below about another 20 yards down, so he's about 40, 45 yards away when I shot him. So, but he just stayed out of it. That's another thing about them. They don't hardly ever travel the same exact point of a trail. They'd be up or down. They're sharp about where they do things.
Yeah. No, it's so tough when you're hunting those types of areas, because the bucks aren't on any sort of pattern or doing, if I find where I think a buck's bedding, it's like he might be bedding there 5% of the time. It's not like he's just laying in this one bed every single day.
Yeah, I don't like ours on that. They have food plots and stuff they plant. And I know people that hunted the area, and nobody ever showed me a picture of it. I don't know if anybody ever had any pictures of him. I killed a big one with a bow a couple of years before that. I got all kind of pictures sent to me of him from like 4 miles away. This cat, I think he didn't go, they don't have to go to a food plot. There's enough browse and they can pick up enough acorns, and when the acorn years is good, they can just want to be nomadic and just eat, browse around, find a good place to bed and stay there till dark again and move up. You know, they got six different bedding areas or whatever. So it's just, at times you would think it'll be kind of easier because they're more nomadic, but they ain't. They just bed up at night anyway. It don't matter where they're at. So.
Yeah.
They'll bed up until night. So.
Yeah. Did you know when you shot him, did you know that was him?
Not when I shot him then, but when I got to him, I did. But,
oh, yeah. Yeah. I meant like when you saw him come out behind that bush, did you know it was him?
I just knew it was big. But, you know, once I seen that big side, I didn't even look at his head when he come out behind that bush.
Yep.
You know, I might have screwed up by seeing that big old, you know, that many points and stuff. Because he was huge. It just seeing him laying on the ground, because he weighed 225 pounds. That's the biggest one I've killed. And he was still, he hadn't lost any weight, I don't think. He was just still huge, big neck, just big body, and it's like you just can't, like, how in the world something like that just live like that when you just walk around? It was amazing. It tore me up. So
that was one of the most impressive things. I mean, you can see it on the cover of the book, but how big the body of that deer was too. Like his neck, his head looked small because his neck was so big, just broad shoulders, just a huge deer.
Yeah, he wasn't a real long body, but he was just a tank, you know, just a muscled up tank, just ready for whatever. It was pretty cool. Is on the bases of his antlers, he got them the little buttons on there. They're chipped up, or what, he barring something that was chipping them horns up down there at the base. So I don't know what he was sparring with, but I don't know. I wouldn't even see any other bucks seeing him walk up. Didn't think about sparring with him, but yeah, something was.
Yeah, that's it, you know, it's funny to me because, you know, they can't see what's on their head, but I feel like if you were to look at somebody, another buck, and he's got a set of antlers like that, you probably know that that's pretty dang big, and you should walk away.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And so when you were hunting him, when you're hunting any of these bucks, do you tend to move around a lot or stay in like the same area, kind of in a travel path waiting for them to come through because they are so nomadic?
Well, like early season, we'll have about a month that we can do like early season hunting. I kind of stay out of my main areas that I'm using that camera data for. I'll try to find an isolated buck somewhere on like a feed tree and do that early season. But after that, from what camera data that I had from the year before, I'll have four or five places during that rut time frame that I can go to where there's been two or three or more bigger bucks travel that edge or that pinch point, and I'll sneak to that. Sometimes I look at the wind. I don't want the wind to go where I think they're coming from or where they're going, but I don't care if it's going across where they're coming from. So I kind of look at that a little bit and just make sure I can get there. And I will spend, if I feel confident in that area that I can get there without, but I always try to make sure my access is where I don't cross any kind of trails if I can help it. And if I do, it's just very limited and where I can see the trail, you know, when I'm up in the tree. So. And if I feel that confident in the area, I'll hunt it 4 days in a row. You know, if I don't have any kind of action, because cameras kind of tell me over the years that it might take, as nomadic as they are, and they're checking on doe groups, that's another kind of key. Our does, when they have their babies, they spread out. They don't have babies together. They kind of spread out, and they still carry them babies up into the rut. They're still kind of like an individual group. Them bucks are traveling around trying to find a doe in heat. So just using that, keeping that mindset, it might take them 3 or 4 or 5 days to come through to go check for that doe group. You know, the reason that they were there the year before or whatever it is, how your process or thought process on why they're crossing through there. So I'll give them some time. I'm a real patient person on that stuff. And I've learned over the years that if you feel confident in that spot, trust your gut and don't try to overthink yourself, because you'll walk yourself out of a deer maybe. So.
Yeah, no, I've talked about it on here a bunch of times, but there was a phase when I was younger where I would just sit in the same tree for like 7 days straight during the rut. If I had a week off, that's what I was doing, in the same tree, and I always killed a buck. Well, then I started taking in too much media, and I was bouncing around and thinking I had first spot is the best, and sitting in places, and I'd go move around, and I was just chasing my own tail, because in the mountains, it's like these deer aren't going down the same places. And a lot of times, you know, if you pay attention to your access, like you're talking about, you're not really boogering things up as bad as an area that has, you know, a ton of deer that are in that specific place. And those bucks are just, especially during the rut, they're moving and checking does. I mean, I remember this one deer I was hunting. I missed him one morning in 2015. He was one of the biggest deer that I'd ever hunted. And that day I had him on camera that morning, like 2.5 miles away on a different camera. And then he hit another camera. And this was like the only time he was hitting cameras in daylight was that day. But he made a big stretch all in one day before he came in front of me later that morning. And it was just wild to me to see how much, you know, country they'll cover.
Yeah. We have like some big power lines and cutovers and, you know, things like that. If they're out looking for a doe, they run a power line or they even run down the side of a road or something, because they know deer cross roads or does cross roads. They're walking down a power line or side of a road for miles just trying to cut a doe in heat scent. So we had a guy that killed a huge 8-point, and they're pretty sure from the what cameras that this deer was caught 8 miles away like 5 days before that. When they're after a doe, and a doe might carry them that far, who knows, but they just, you don't know how far they'll go. You know, I know I've had one I killed, it was 3 or 4 miles away, the guy on camera. So, and then most of the time you'll have, you know, bucks on my trail cameras that only have one picture of, they just come through at one time, one certain time frame, just checking for doe, and you don't see them again. You know, they might've come by and not by the camera, but you won't see them again until the next season, because they're out of their home area. Because, you know, that's another thing you kind of got to think about is hill country and mountain country. You know, when you're doing your postseason count stuff, they're already back as a bachelor group. So, you know, your 3.5-year-olds and 2.5s, they might be groups of 5 to 6 something, but your monster buck, to me, a lot of times he'd bite by himself, but like that one I killed, he had another buck at 7-point with him. And what cameras I had of him pictures I had of him during the summer and spring, they were always together.
Hmm.
And during the spring and the summer, that big buck was leading that 6 or 7-point. And then when hunting season come around, he was letting that 7-point lead. So it's kind of funny, but you got to kind of think about that. So whenever they bust up in the fall, you know, they're going to spread out and get away from each other, because they don't tolerate each other living there close. But whenever they look for does, they'll intersect, you know, run across each other. Or get in the same area. So when you're thinking about that process, or what I'm trying to think of is, all right, you know, you're looking at a big picture, you got food plots, you know, parking areas, mountains, hills, things everywhere. Where can you get, or this is what I'm thinking of when I'm putting trail cameras out, where can you get, or where is this deer going across going to get to them 3 points, or them 2 or 3 food plots 2 miles away, whatever are these, and trying to pick places out that I can get to and put cameras out and then see how, why, and when, or trying to figure out, you know, a time frame of when they're crossing through there in the daylight, and make sure I can get there and access it and hunt it. And I, during the rut, I'll spend 3 or 4 days. You know, early season, you know, I'd rather run and gun, because I've busted myself, you know, busting them out in the morning, because a lot of times in the morning they're so close to where you're trying to hunt at. Because they don't, you know, and when the acorns start falling, there's still so much browse and stuff, they bed pretty close to where the acorns is at. So morning hunt, early season, is tough, because a lot of times you can go in there before daylight, they're there, you know, somewhere close, and they see you, you know, or sneak out. So it's a little bit easier in the evening, but still harder than the rut to me. But so it's kind of tough, you know, early season, because we got so much browse. And like I say, when the acorns falling, they're just bedding right there pretty close to them. And that makes it tough early season. So the rut, to me, finding the right place you can spend 3 or 4 days and then move on. But early season, that running gun style, I like it. I like finding 3 or 4 feed tree with big droppings, or maybe some rubs close to it, or some scrapes that's fresh. And then you've only, like here, we've only got a couple of weeks to do that. When they start putting them scrapes out, things are changing, you know, quick. So.
Yeah. Are you hunting, when you say the feed trees, are you hunting right over the feed trees, or are you just like, how are you thinking about those?
I'm trying to get between where I'm thinking they're bedding at. But like on the same, in the mornings, I try to get on the same level is where I think they're bedded, you know, it'd be on the side of the ridge or on top of the ridge, like, or maybe a shelf. But in the evenings, I generally try to get up tight to where I feel like where I have actually seen tracks most of the time. I don't hunt a place in the evening where I've actually seen a track coming down off the side of the mountain or the hill going across, and then I'll set up close to that track. So give out a couple of hunts, and I'll move on to the next one, just trying to catch one come off from where I think they're bedding at there.
Yeah. No, that definitely makes sense. And how much, or I guess one more question on the feed trees. So when you're talking about a ridge that has a bunch of oaks on it and everything, how are you distinguishing, like, this is the feed tree that you want to hunt?
Yeah, well, I'm a misspoke. Most of the time, it's not going to be a ridge that's got a bunch of oaks on it. It's going to be like isolated oaks off of a pine thicket or some kind of cut over edge or something thick, nasty, is isolated trees, not really groups of trees.
That makes sense. So something, so it's kind of a lone tree or a lone group of trees amongst other vegetation that's there versus just finding a big oak ridge and trying to figure out what's the best tree.
Right. Yeah. You can kind of see that on these new, I'm still not as familiar with a lot of folks on them. I'm looking at maps and visual, satellite imagery, but you can find a lot of them places, like it. If you look close enough, looking for with wintertime imagery, finding pines and stuff, and then finding, the bare trees like oak trees, and then look at them, post season, just trying to find out where the white oaks. And sometimes I feel like the red oaks is more, I don't know, but I think bucks like more sometimes, but I don't know if it's because either they like them or they know that the other deer don't like them and they don't have no more competition for it or something. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, that's an interesting thought process. And you'd mentioned a couple times about using that historical data, whether it's cameras or you're hunting, as far as, planning for that upcoming season. How much do you weigh that historical data versus the, kind of real time data that you find versus like tracks and stuff along those lines?
To me, it's real important, this place, because of our deer population is less, less density, I'll kind of spread out more and I look and I have a bigger area. And I try always finding some newer areas. But when I move on to this other place down south around a swamp area, I got the same tree. They don't matter. I just go down there and get that same tree. If I don't feel like it's been an active area for some reason, I might move. But generally, most of the time, I can go to that same tree then within 3 or 4 days and have a 4-year-old or something come by and get an opportunity to, and see plenty of those. It's just I just learned over time from this swamp area, just in between, some food plots and some old cutover.
Well, I'm shooting a new bow this year and I am pumped. After playing around with a buddy's Hoyt RX8, the smile on my face made the decision for me. The first thing I noticed with the new Hoyts were their extremely smooth draw cycles and the ability to adjust the back wall to make it rock solid like I prefer. I outfitted my own RX-8 with the inline accessories that made installation extremely easy and balanced out the bow. My favorite accessory so far is a simple one. It's the GoStix 2.0 adjustable legs to make your bow like a tripod, but it doesn't interfere with any part of the bow or the limbs or anything like that. In addition, the integrated kickstand within the HBX Exact cams protect your string from excess wear when you put your cam into the dirt. Ground hunting or spot and stalk just got easier. If you want to experience what I'm talking about, head to your nearest Hoyt dealer and take a test drive yourself. You can learn more at Hoyt.com. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a consumer-based hunting show unlike any other. It provides an interactive learning experience where you can try all things mobile hunting and learn from the best in the business. Come experience an unbiased, community-based environment where you can improve your hunting skills and find the right equipment for your needs. I'll be speaking at the Nor'easter Show in Mannheim, Pennsylvania at Spooky Nook Sports from August 9th to 11th, 2024. So come check it out or either of the other shows in Michigan and Georgia. You can purchase tickets online at themobilehuntersexpo.com. Or grab tickets at the door. I'll see you there.
That leads up to some points that were fine points that got sage grass. Them does like bedding on when it's cooler. And them bucks will cut the edge of that swamp, going to check them sage pockets out. And just if you're patient, you know, you'll want to come by. If you play, if you don't get in there right without spooking them and patient, you'll have one come by. So I don't know. I kill a 4.5-year-old six point this year that down there, and like on the third day or something. And but just about every year, every other year, I'll kill a buck out of that tree. So I've caught, and I've killed 40 out of that tree. So, and a bunch of, you know, 100 inch, you know, 140 is pretty rare down there, but a bunch of other, like 100, 110 inch, you know, good bucks were there. So,
yeah, no, that makes sense. And so how do you keep track of all that as far as like, well, that tree, obviously, you know where you're going into, but you go to an area and you have historical data there. Oh, right there. There it is, the journal.
All that right there, all the data. I've got data all the way back to 1988.
Do you really? Yeah, I can. Oh, my gosh.
I used to write all that down on calendars. I get calendars from the bank. And I'd write down all these hunts. I'd write down everything I see on there. And then about 10 years ago, I transferred all of it to this book, and I started keeping up with it in this book. So write down what I see, the dates, you know, and if the weather's kind of odd, write that down. Then definitely write down the kills and what time, you know, if it's raining or whatever. But I keep up all that stuff. And my trail camera data on my computer, I keep everything that I call a shooter buck on there or a potential shooter on there. And I go back, look at them dates, the times, and just keep up with all that stuff, kind of correlate it. You know, like this past year, we had a crazy year. We didn't have any acres. I'm talking about very minimal. We didn't even have a daggum hickory nut. We didn't have a dang hickory nut. And then squirrels worked themselves deaf. So pine cones and stuff last year, it was awful. And it was a lesson for a lot of folks, you know, even me, because I would have thought they would have moved more trying to find food, but they didn't. They found something they could browse on, and they stayed there, and it was thick, and they just didn't come out unless they was kicked out. So keeping up that stuff over the years, anything like that just could mean anything, because you'll forget about it, you know, a lot of stuff, you know,
yeah.
Hunt season, you'll have so much going on during hunt season, if you don't write it down, you'll forget about it, you know, so. I keep all of it wrote down and pertinent information. And then when I'm sitting there not doing anything, I'll look back through it. Especially when we go camping, I'll have that book in there and I'll be flashing back, looking kind of for 10 years or whatever, trying to keep up what was going on, what time of the year. Because generally, you have everybody that talks about the moon and, you know, weather and all that stuff. And that I can understand part of that. But that rut is generally a certain time frame. It might be more active at night, or it might be more active certain moons, but it's going to be during that time frame. You know, you just might not be in the exact area you need to be in. So kind of think of that. So that's what I go by is dates. Them dates mean more to me than any kind of moon weather. You know, the weather, if you like hunting fronts, you know, that's fine, but and correlating it with them dates. And them dates are still going to be there regardless of what kind of weather or what. They're not going to wait for the best weather to rut, so it's because the sunlight, basically the amount of sunlight hours, my understanding is what tells them to rut, and that's what they're doing. So if it's 100 degrees, they might do it at night, or if it's 20 degrees, they might be more active in the daylight. But you still got to put your time in there. If you're not putting your time in, you're just taking away from your chances to make it.
Yeah, no, that no, you, I would agree with that. And it's funny. So my dad has all these notebooks. He's been writing down every hunt that he's had and having the same thing that you've done forever. And he's the one that taught me to do that. And then I moved it. I went a little more digital. So in Spartan Forge, there's a journaling feature in there, and you can do it and associate it with a waypoint, but it has all of your journal entries. And then it also takes the weather for that day and adds it in there. So really? when you go back, you can look at all that stuff and be able to see it. So that's what I've been using now, because I'll just, as things happen, I'm in the tree, I just kind of write and add things to it and just have all of it right there. And then I can go back and refer to it and look at it. But it's pretty nice to be able to do that. Cause I like to think I can remember things, but the little details and the specifics, not so much at all. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I look back at those notes and I'm like, oh, I forgot that happened and it was this date. And, you know, especially when you get to, you know, you get to the rut and you're not doing very good and your mind jumbled and you're starting to second guess everything. It's nice to have real data to look back and be like, okay, I got to trust this and, you know, maybe try this again and in these specific spots, because we see annual data being so helpful here in Pennsylvania as well.
Yeah. I mean, you know, some year you like it don't show up exactly, but and the only reason that is because it might have happened 100 yards over here and you just can't see it. You know, it's just you're not exactly in the right place. So just keep them dates in mind. I even had I think when I was at Buckmaster Show, Lecter had that big deer down there and somebody come by, had some kind of app or program. He said, do you know what day, you remember what day you killed that deer, what time, all that? I said, yeah. Matter of fact, I had this book with me. So I carry it with me. People ask questions. So, and I showed him. He said, well, I'm going to look at my program, and I guarantee you this program is going to tell me that match up that date, and then I'll pay you to advertise for it. And I said, all right, let's do it. So, no, he wasn't there. He just,
really?
So, a couple more minutes. But I already had another guy that was real big on the moon stuff and the overfoot, overhead, underfoot, and all that, and he went through that book, all the kills that I had, and not one of them correlated with any of them.
So, really?
Yeah, And it could, but the biggest thing is, about especially on pupland, there's so many other variables that could put nearby, you know. So you don't worry about one variable. There's about four or five other things that could happen. So I don't want to, and I try to stress this to a lot of folks, don't try to get tunnel vision on certain processors or certain ways you want to hunt, because there's a lot of other variables, a lot of other things that could happen to put that deer by you. So the main variable is you. You know, you got to put yourself there in the daylight, and, you know, and then the other stuff you can't really control. You know, you control how you get there, access, and how you know your equipment and what you can do, and trust yourself and trust your judgment. Then don't worry about any of the other stuff, because don't worry about the moon or whatever. Just put yourself in that position and be patient. Then that the rest of it you can't really control. So.
Yeah, and you And I believe you do this similar to what I do too, is like, I don't know if you call it the same. I can't remember from the book, but I build out something every year that I call a hunt plan. So I have 3 to 5 main areas that are usually like either different pieces of public land or different large chunks of an area. And then I have 3 to 5 spots within those, and I have them listed out. And then I'll have any details of like what wind direction makes sense for this or time of year, anything. So I have that plan and I'll print it out and I have it. So then when I get to a point where I'm like, all right, I'm frustrated or I'm not, you know, doing as good and I need, or there's too much hunting pressure, whatever, I need to move to another spot. It's like it's a strategic thing. I can look at this and be like, okay, I know I should go try this spot out, or I should try this place. And it for me personally, it takes off the anxiety of trying to figure things out on the fly.
Right. If you spend more time concentrating, learning, say, like you said, an area, a mile and a half, 2 miles, or whatever it is, 5 mile area, a big block that you know has got the deer you want to take, or what kind of deer you want to take, or the availability there you want to take, learn that all you can, then put them times together, or the weeks together, and have different places that you can get into, you know, without tracking it up or without crossing trails, and you can move like that. You know, you can spend 4 or 5 days in a place that's a previous producer or whatever, but you also got 3 more places that same time frame you can sneak in there too. You're just saving them. Don't, you know, if you can go to 3 different places in that week, then you don't burn all your places pretty much. So
yeah.
So just be strategic, just like you said about that, and patient. And that works out, you know, good to me. Is the biggest thing is learning your area, you know. And sometimes when you have you check out a place for 2 or 3 days and it ain't just jiving up, you can always just sneak in there and then see and hunt your way in, then hunt there. You know, if it ain't there, you know, you're just wasting 1 day. So, I mean, you got other days, but just be more strategic about it and have your plan, just like you say. And I always tell myself, stick with that plan, because your plan, you know, it's worked for you from, you know, as successful as I've been or whatever. It's always sooner or later worked out for me, and stick with it no matter how bad it seems it is. So,
yeah. Oh no, that makes sense. And do you, and you hunt with you hunt with like a group of people, not technically. I mean, I'm not saying like you're hunting with them in the tree or anything, but you have like a group, including your wife and others that you kind of help each other out and right. do that kind of stuff too, don't you?
Yeah, we got a network of people that's hunting the same area. You know, they might be 5 miles away, whatever. But we're all kind of sharing information about what we're seeing and how we think the movement is. And if somebody kills one, we'll get contact, we help, you know. So you need that, really. It's, you know, you try to be a little bit private about some things, but you really need a good group or network of people that you can trust and do that and build that relation with to get through them things. So. And that helps a lot. So, yeah, we got, say, 5 or 6 people. So, yeah, I think there's a picture in that book with 4 or 5 that helped get that deer out. So,
yeah,
that kind of a group really means a lot and helps a lot. So, my wife is the main, you know, she's my main partner. You know, over the years, before she got to hunting a whole lot, when my son was in school and she was taking care of him, I went through 2 or 3 people, but they just didn't have the patience or didn't want to deal with the ruggedness and of my thought process was, because most of the time I'm not seeing that many deer, you know, and the way I do it is if you're seeing too many young bucks, whatever, you're kind of probably in the wrong spot. So, and when you do see one or, you know, it could be a big one. So I went through several, you know, hunter partners, whatever, or they had other things going on, whatever. And then when my wife started hunting and my son's out of the house now, so she's my main partner, you know, she sticks with me. You know, scouting and everything. Bad weather, cold weather. You know, we carry a camper and do that. So we used to tent camp all the time. But now we just, you know, camper is a lot easier. So we got a few adopted dogs that we got that we carry with us. So we have a good time just making a family thing. And we'll have people come out of camp. We'll talk and share stories and, you know, look at deer. People come by and bring deer in the back of the truck, whatever, and look at them. So it's a fun thing. That's one of the coolest things about this. The outdoor relationship you have with all these people, the stories and the camaraderie that you have with all these, your buddies and friends. So.
Yeah, no, I like that. And it's kind of like a mobile deer camp, you know, where like we have a deer camp that's stationary where everyone, you know, during hunting season, there's always someone there at night and everyone's coming up. And whenever someone gets a vehicle or gets a buck, everyone's texting everyone, and all of a sudden vehicles are coming in and out of the driveway, coming up and checking them out and standing there and telling stories. And yeah. You know, it's a little different. Mine's all my family as far as my network, I'll call it. But as far as anybody shoots something, it's like, you know, the text goes out and it's like, all right, when do you want to go in and start looking? And then, you know, people come in and do that. We all hunt different areas essentially, but like we all have our own spots, but we all go help each other out when it's needed. And I love being able to do that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like we're just camped on like a primitive hunting camp. We carry a generator with us and we've got, you know, a pretty good popularity or following now that if somebody kills something they pretty much know we're camping there and anywhere on that 90-something-thousand acre, they kill one, they're coming by to show it to us or talk to us. And we enjoy every bit of that. That's part of what.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really fun to be able to have that and have everyone come by and see them. And it's, I don't know. That's really cool. And I just find so many similarities now that you're the third person in a row here that I've interviewed that's from the South. And I hadn't interviewed a bunch of people from the South in the past until I realized it's like, there's so many similarities with hunting traditions and hunting styles and the terrain. And yeah, there's, you know, the differences that come in there too. But at the same time, it's like, there's so much of those similarities. I was talking to Jacob and Andrew and I was like, they told me like, you should come down and hunt with us sometime and, you know, camp out and just, you know, go hunt for a week or whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I'd love to do that. That'd be fun.
Yeah. Come on, do it. That'd be fun. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
I think you just talked Shane Parker not too long ago.
Yeah.
I met him. I finally met him in person at the Mobile Hunter Expo and talked to him a little bit. He hunts a similar style, but like a different mountain range. So that's all that's neat. So it's pretty cool how you hunt, you know, got similar tactics and all that. Then when you talk to somebody else and they're doing kind of the same thing and you get to share, you know, strategies and stories, and it's real neat. So.
Yeah, no, and I love, you know, hearing it. It's crazy to me. Like, one question I had earlier was, you know, you were talking about how Alabama didn't really have many big bucks a while back. What changed, do you think, like, with that? Because you still can shoot a lot of deer in the state, where, you know, Pennsylvania, I really believe that it's both the antler restrictions that they put on, and we're only a one buck state, and then also the forest management. There's a lot more timber cuts, they're creating better habitat, and then the deer density's lower, so they have better food and everything than it used to be. But I'm curious to hear what you think about in Alabama.
Yeah, we got a bunch of deer. You know, the biggest thing has helped is a lot of the TV stuff and a lot of the social media stuff is showing the capabilities of what you can kill. So they're people have, even before they change, you know, used to we kill a buck a day, every day, and it matter. You know, from October 15th to January 31st, you kill a buck a day and a doe a day, every day. And there were still big deer getting killed, you know, so. But as TV and stuff come around, even before they change the limit, people were seeing what they could kill, and while you're hunting bucks with them, you know, we've only got, say, we're less than 1 million acres of public land, say 700-something thousand, I think. So most of our land is private. And you know, a lot of hunting clubs. So hunting clubs and some of your forestry companies started putting out rules, you know, for bigger bucks and limits. So a lot of your hunting clubs, so you need to shoot it, you know, say a 16-inch spread or whatever. They were putting on management strategies, and then a lot of people on their own seeing what Bill Jordan and all that killing. So wait, we can do that too. So they were taking on their own and start passing deer. Then Alabama, the conservation department, put the 3-buck limit in. Changed it from, you know, unlimited bucks to 3, and one of them's got to have 4 points on one side. And that's, you know, I guess that's helped. I kind of worry about that a little bit, because sometimes when you say that, people say, well, I got to kill 3. That's like a challenge, you know. So
yeah.
But instead, before, they, well, I can kill a buck anytime I want to. So they wasn't really worried about it. So I got mixed feelings on that. I think the biggest thing has helped is people are being more choosy,
you know. Yeah.
So, And I like it, but another thing is I don't want anybody to be restricted. You know, if they want meat or whatever, and they don't have the limited time to hunt, if a spike or whatever is what they need to shoot to eat, that's fine too. I don't, you know, that don't bother me. The doe thing to me is we got to a lot of deer in some places, and controlling that more would help. Then the bad side of that is like when we hunt this. The main public land where I killed that big deer, I don't like messing with the does early because I want them to feel safe and unpressured to help get the buck by me. So that's kind of mixed feelings. I want to try to shoot them after that if I can, or I'll just go somewhere else and shoot a doe for meat. So if I can, so that's mixed feelings. You know, if a perfect scenario for me was if you had the perfect land, you had the complete control over it, was not to mess with your does until after the rut, then call out what you needed to. You know, I would think that would be a better strategy to have a relaxed deer population and be more successful with a bigger buck. But who knows? I mean, that's just my thought. But I don't want to shoot a doe in my main hunting area because I'm afraid it's going, you know, bleeding blood and all that's going. Uh oh, he's here. So then everything changes.
I'm the same way. It's so funny. Every year I'm like, I should just shoot a doe early so I get some meat in the freezer, and you know, I got that out of the way. I could focus on bucks, but then I never want to because of what you just said. It's like I don't want to screw anything up. I don't want to, I say I'm going to shoot one later, and then when I try to shoot one later, it's harder. It's like for some reason, it's like why I had all these opportunities early that I passed on, and now later I'm struggling to even see a doe.
That's true. But my thing is, like, I had this one place I killed two bucks in a row, 2 years in a row. A doe brought her by. I'm thinking, I wonder if that's that doe from the year before. So I'm hoping she's here next year and stuff like that. Well, last year I didn't see her. So somebody might have got her. I don't know. But I don't want to mess with her because she's helped me kill two good bucks. So that, you know, it's corrupted my mind now. So I don't want to shoot them because that might be Susie that brought that buck by me. So
Yeah. And too, like I've learned some of these areas that I've spent so much time in, I know these certain doe groups and when they tend to come into estrus and when, or at least when bucks are starting to, you know, check these certain right. ones. And I'm like, I don't want to accidentally shoot her, you know, cause if that happens, then is that going to screw everything up? Or is all my historical data going to be thrown out the window for this spot?
Yeah. And you know, and a lot of times them doe groups are still, you know, small groups. If you shoot the older doe, that's the one that's kind of educating, helping them get through the coyotes and that process. So you got to, there's a lot more thinking to it, you know, that you get thinking too much. But, hey, what if I do that? You know, how it's going to screw up everything, their hierarchy or whatever. You know, if you shoot the grandma doe, it's learned everything for the 10 years on how to elude people or how to train a buck, how to be smarter, you know, because I really believe, you know, I've watched does do some crazy things. I watched a doe in one place circle a whole food plot with a fawn 10 yards inside the woods, stopping every so often, looking and training that fawn to do that before she got around and come out pretty close to him. It was still far away where I couldn't shoot her. But she done circling there that whole food plot, just patiently teaching that fawn, you know, hey, that's trouble. You just got to sneak out there, you know, or just get your thing, scent check, look, you know, make sure before you go. So that thought process, like, man, I, you know, it's cool, but you just don't, you know, it's cool the things you see, and then you start questioning about what you're going to do, you know, because everything you do affects something. So try to make it where it's going to affect a benefit for you. So not a negative down the road, and trying to figure that out for, you know, plan for the future, it makes it tough sometimes.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And it is so cool to be able to see all these things and, you know, be in the woods and witness it and kind of come to your own conclusions on what they're doing and thinking about it. I mean, that's such a great, great part about hunting. I love it. And every area has its own little things.
My dad had a story. He said, I know a doe can count to three because I've seen one do it one time. He said he's seen a doe go behind three hunters and then come back by with a fawn and stop and point them hunters out when she come by. You know, so she knew where they was all at. She said, I know she could count three.
That's really funny. One other thing I wanted to ask you back when we were talking about, you know, the groups of people and you call them, and I'm always interested in this. How do you get your bucks out of the woods typically?
It's always with a deer cart or dragging. You know, used to we'd drag 5 or 6 hours, you know, but deer cart, I've never packed one out. You know, I know it's getting popular, and I just want to get up there to the checking station because you're supposed to carry them to the checking station. I want to get them up our hole and just see what the weight was and, you know, see everything. So we can roll them out with a cart. It might take 5 or 6 hours or so, but generally I can get some help. So if it's too bad, you know, a lot of people are going toward that jet sled. I've talked to a guy this year that used one out there, and he said you'd be surprised how much easier a jet sled is than dragging. So
what do you mean by a jet sled? Just like a snow sled?
Like a snow sled. So it's just a solid like piece of plastic. It's kind of bold that you put the deer in, and you can drag them over rocks, logs, and all that. You ain't hurting the hide. Like you're going to mount it and just easier, and, you know. So he said it's more, a little bit more maneuverable than a cart with them wheels, but, you know, I haven't driven one yet, so I'd have to see it. But I like gearing them out whole. That's me. You know, a lot of people, one of my things is, you know, you don't worry about anything else. You got to get them flat first. Then you getting them out and all that comes later. You know, all that's the gravy part. The hardest part is getting yourself in position to get them flat. Once you get them flat, you can get them out somehow or another. So don't worry about all that stuff. Get them flat first, and then anything, you know, you can come up with other stuff. So.
Yeah, it's funny because when I started hunting out west and learning, you know, packing deer out and stuff, and I was like, oh, this is great. And I started, you know, doing that in Pennsylvania. But then it was like one of the biggest things for us is we get back to camp and we hang them there and everyone comes by and looks at them and does that. And I'm like, well, I'm kind of missing out on that. You know, I'll never forget in 2017, I shot one of the biggest bodied bucks I'd ever shot. And I was by myself and I had no cell service. And I'm like, I got to get him out of here. But I was like, I want to show everybody at camp. And I had my frame pack and I could have cut him up. And I was like, I spent the whole day dragging him out through these, you know, these clear cuts that had all these branches down that were tough. I'm trying to keep the hide off it. So, cause I was going to mount him and try to get it up. And it was just funny to hear that. But I ran into a guy and in gun season 1 year way back in, and I talked to this guy for 20 minutes because he's never seen anybody else back in this spot, and it was my first time in there. And he had a sled that was that would roll up. It was like a snow sled, but it rolled up, and he had it on the back of his pack. And he said that's how he gets the deer out of this place, because it was rugged and it was back in there. But we've used deer carts forever. That's kind of been my family's thing too. We've also taken logs and then you put them over your shoulder, another person behind it, and tie the deer up around that.
That's part of the enjoyment, like dragging with somebody. You know, you drag a while, stop and talk and tell a story. You know, you'll talk more probably than you drag. And it's kind of funny. Was me and my brother was in Wyoming public land hunting, and he killed his first ever mule deer and his only mule deer, like a 3-buck 2 or something. No monster, you know, like a 2-year-old. And we toted that thing between us off and on 7 miles. You know, we stopped and talked. We had packs. We could have packed that thing out, but we're just so used to the Alabama thing of toting them or dragging them. But we throw that thing on our shoulders and we walk, stop, talk, drink water, you know, for 7 miles away from the camp. So it was fun. That's just part of it. It's just part of the experience. You know, we enjoyed it. So.
Yeah. No, and that's always been my thing. I never think of when I go into an area, how am I going to get a deer out of here? That's always an afterthought. I don't even want to think about it. Just get it down and then worry about that.
Now, if you elk hunting or moose hunting or something like that, you know, that might be different. But you know,
I was just going to say that when I go on my moose hunt this year in Alaska, like that's a little bit different. I can't just go 5 miles away from camp and shoot a moose and expect to get them back.
Yeah, that's a whole different animal right there.
No, that's true. You've done some Alaska hunting, haven't you?
I've been to Alaska 3 times, 2 brown bear. Coastal brown bear and 1 black bear on the same hunt, and an Arctic grizzly bear on a different hunt. So very cool hunts. I mean, Alaska is, if I could go there every year, that's one of the most amazing places they are. And if I was a young guy, man, I would think about moving out there somewhere for about 6-7 years and try to hunt the sheep and the, you know, mountain goats, moose, caribou, black-tailed deer, everything they got, because you can do it, you know, if you live there. And they just got so many different kind of unique animals to hunt. And it's a very unique place. I'm trying to get my wife out there just to tour it, because it's so diverse and different types of mountain escapes versus the tundra and tussock and all that stuff. It's just so neat. The boreal forest down there on the coast and by the ocean. Like one place I went, the main camp was right by the ocean in the Prince William Sound area. And we ain't been off there's a 30-mile boat ride from Cordova and on this beach. Anyway, we got there and was getting set up. We heard something. We're not there on that beach. There's a humpback whale going by blowing, you know. You're just seeing so many different things, you know, the whales, the otters, the seals, and you know, seeing wolves, coyotes, I mean, you know, mountain goats, dogs, sheep, just caribou, whatever. It's just so many things you can see and this other wildlife, the eagles everywhere, and just it's just amazing. You can sit there on a beach and looking at snow-capped mountains is one of the most amazing things to me, you know, that they are. And then the other thing is hunting an animal that's so big that it can take off faster than a quarter horse, you know, run 40 mile an hour and can get you anywhere they are to get you. And you're sleeping out there in a tent with them and then hunting them. That I really love stuff like that too. So. But I've enjoyed it, and I've been successful in all them. I've killed 2 brown bears, the Arctic grizzly, and the black bear up there. And I've done some Canada black bear hunts with the bow, you know, baited hunts. I've killed one with a recurve, and my wife killed a huge one with a crossbow, a 400-something pounder that just liked a little bit Ben Boone and Crockett on one of them hunts. And I've also done a moose hunt in New Brunswick and killed, you know, a moose there. And that animal, you know, when you're looking – I carried my bow, but you couldn't. There, they had a law where you couldn't have both weapons with you. So I had made my mind up. So I left my bow at the camp and carried my rifle and ended up shooting this 40-something inch spread moose, a nice moose for the area at like 50-something yards. You know, I might have been able to hit with. Well, I probably could have hit with a bow. So anyway, that was a cool hunt. But you're looking through that scope, looking at this moose, and it ain't no different than looking at a deer. You just see an animal in there and crosshair, you wait for the right shot, shoot. But when you get in there and walk up on that thing, and it's, you know, that sucker's like 12 yards long. Like 1,100, I think it's 1,100 something pounds, y'all. So it just, what in the world? But anyway, as lucky as the place was at, they drove a tractor for 4 or 5 miles, got back there and picked it up with a box blade tractor or a bucket tractor and carried it back to camp. So it was by a fire break, and we could get him out that way, or they would have cut him up. But it was just luck played out that we could get him back there with a tractor. But
yeah,
but that's a cool hunt. That grunting and the horn raking on them trees that they do, you could feel that grunt off your chest like a subwoofer bass or something. Just, oh, you know, just, oh,
yeah,
just getting. And it's like, what in the world is that? Hey, that's a bull moose coming. I you know, I heard about the grunt, but feeling that was like, it was crazy. And then he'd stop in the woods. You hear him just tearing a tree up, and it sounded like somebody's in there, a boat paddle, just wearing a tree out. And then he comes out. You know, that's actually an exciting hunt, and them things are good to eat. You know, that's some fine eating. So,
yeah, moose is my favorite meat I've had so far out of the wild game.
That's amazing how sweet that meat was to me, the sweeter flavor. We eat on that thing for two and a half years, I think. We carried a chest top freezer up around the trailer, 30 something hour drive, and had that thing full and give away a couple hundred pounds of meat or whatever it was to the guide and the family, and then brought the hide and stuff, mounted him and all that. But we got home and vacuum sealed every bit of it. Got home, took a week to vacuum seal all of it. They had it froze for us, but we went ahead and vacuum sealed it. But it was some fine eating for 2 years, you know, just.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just sharing, having cookouts and carrying some to work and cooking it. You know, it's just that hunt is worth just the meat, you know, let alone the antler process. But.
Oh, man. I'm looking forward to it. I really hope that I'm able to have a story like that where, you know, we come back with one. There's two of us with tags. My buddy's going with a bow, and I'm taking a gun, and we're going to try it and see how it goes, getting dropped off at a lake and just setting up camp for 10 days.
That's awesome. Are you going to have bear tag too, or just a moose tag?
Not a brown bear. I think I'm going to get a black bear tag while I'm there too, because it's unguided, so I can't shoot a grizzly or anything up there. But
right, yeah, that's what I meant. You know, a black bear you can hunt as a non-resident, and moose, of course, and a caribou. I think blacktail.
Yeah,
but the bears, and the sheep and goats, you got to have a guide. So. You're gonna enjoy that hunt, and it. But you've been there last before, right?
Yeah, I went caribou hunted there in 2020, and that's where I decided I was like, if I can find a way to get back, and that's so. I actually have a Sitka blacktail hunt planned this year too, and late October, early November, which is hard for me to do that with deer season. But I was like, I really want to do this, and I had booked it a couple years ago. And then the moose hunt came up as an opportunity. A friend of mine asked me to join on. He got in with this transporter, and I was like, I don't know how I'm going to swing 2 Alaska hunts in a year. But at the same time, I was like, I may, you know, I may not get this opportunity, so I'll figure it out. And I need to go for it. So
yeah, that's another one of them things. You get the opportunity on something like that, do it. Worry about the rest later, because man, that's an amazing place. Or on the caribou, you go up in the Brooks Range or above the Brooks Range, or
yeah, the north slope of the Brooks Range.
Wow, so I was on the close to the north slope. We was up on the upper Shinjack. It's like I was telling people like that on that hunt. If something happened to you, it was about 6 hours by plane to get you back to a hospital somewhere. So it was you out there and dang nowhere. I mean, but it's amazing country, beautiful. Just ain't got to worry about no vehicles, no phone stuff. I mean. Might see a plane come by every now and then, but it's somebody going up to the North Slope to that oil field or something. So, but other than that, man, it was amazing. You know, I love that stuff.
Yeah. Oh man, I remember. I'll never forget looking through a spotting scope, and because it's wide open, but it was kind of the mountains there, but it was still wide open, and we saw some grizzlies up on the one hill. I mean, he was probably 4 miles away when we looked on the maps, but you know, he didn't look that far away when you're looking through the spotting scope. And then there was one that was that went into these alders. And at the time, you know, I hadn't really seen these alders before. And from a distance, they look like they're, you know, they look like they're a foot tall. And and I thought maybe all the grizzly went over the saddle, and then some caribou showed up and they bedded on this like cliff face. And me and my buddy were like, all right, let's go up after these caribou. That grizzly's gone. You know, we start going up there and we realize these alders are 8 or 10 foot tall. And it's like, he could be in here. I was like, how about you go first, buddy? You know?
Yeah. That's one thing about, you know, I've been to Wyoming several times. You know, Wyoming's big. You know, you look at something, you know, that's pretty far over there. Alaska is bigger. Yeah. You know, like the guy said, get that pack, go down and go get some water. So I looked, you know, there's a river down there. And so I looked at that river, hey, I'll be down there. So I took off without my rifle and walked down there to that river. About 30 minutes later, I stopped, looked back up there toward the tent. And I still got another 15, 20 minutes to get down that dang river. And I'm thinking, why in the world I didn't bring my gun? You know, like you say, them trees down there look like bushes. When you get down there, they're dead gum trees, you know, tall, you know, yeah, 20 foot tall. And you're thinking, there's a bear could be down here and I'm a goner. But anyway, nothing happened bad. The guy had a little talk with me when I got back because, you know, Alabama boy, I wasn't really aware of everything. You know, that was my first time to Alaska. So after that, I kept that rifle on me. But yeah, it's crazy how big it is compared to other places that are big, you know, so it's just that much bigger. So.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. You think you'll get back up there again for another hunt? You going to try to go up there again?
I'm going to try my best. I picked up a 375 H&H Magnum this past year. Because every time I went up on them brown bear hunts, I don't have a rifle big enough. But the guy on that Arctic, the grizzly hunt, he let me carry my 30-06. I'm a big 30-06 fan, so that's one reason I went with him, was to do that 30-06. But them brown bear, them guys on brown bear hunt, they would let me. I borrowed a 338 that they had, but they prefer 416, you know, Remington mags, you know, big guns. And I, on that second brown bear hunt, I found out why, because them things are tough, you know. The first one I killed, I dropped him. He was a good size brown bear. He was a 9-foot, 11-inch square. Just, you know, if I hadn't shot him in the head, he'd been a Boone and Crockett. He was walking right straight toward us, and I was trying to shoot him above the head on that hunt because I was getting a cramp, and he was just still steadily coming straight toward us, and like at 100 and something yards. Guy said, if you can shoot him in that hunt, shoot him. So anyway, I squeezed off. I hit him right above the eyes, right between the head, and it dropped him like a sack of potatoes. So. But that second one, we couldn't get no closer than like 200 something yards from him. And the guy asked me as I was comfortable, and I said, I said, how flat will these rifle shoot? He said, just hold a little high. So I took it when I hold a little high, I was like over his back a little bit. So the first shot I squeezed off went over him, and he didn't know what happened. He kind of looked around, froze. So I dropped it down on that second shot, and you could hear that bullet hit. Well, when that bullet hit, that son of a gun jumped like a cat, turned around, started tearing up bushes and stuff, and was looking around trying to figure out what was going on. And I commenced shooting again, and every bullet would hit. He would jump around, tear up stuff, and would growl so loud that you could hear it echoing down the dang valley forever. And I'm thinking, you know, that son of a gun. Anyway, I reloaded like, I'll say, three times, and finally got this bear took care of. But if that would have happened to him being close and he would have seen us, he probably would have come over and done some damage. I don't know. I mean, them things are a lot tougher than you think. And you hear all the stories, and they said they got proof. You could shoot a bear in the heart, especially a brown bear, and their heartbeats are so low per minute that they can go a couple hundred yards without a heart and tear something up. So that's why they tell you, you keep shooting through the shoulder and do as much damage as you can, because you, if you don't drop him right there and he goes in them alders, somebody's got to track him, you know. And them things can do, like I say, they can do some damage. If you don't drop him out there in that thing, tundra or whatever, and he gets in them alders, you know, by your ethics, somebody got to go in there and try to do your best to find that thing, you know.
Because yeah,
if you find blood and, you know, and you don't find it, you know, your hunt's over with. So. And they had so many stories about, one story was a guy shot one, and it went up in his alders. They shot it two or three times. It went up in some alders up his hill. They give it a little time, and they start up there, and they start tracking blood. Then they said, I think we're just going to wait till in the morning. So, all right. So they went back, and they picked up another guy. Well, they start going up there following that blood. This one guy, the new guy that was with them, said, hey, there's a bear laying right there. Well, over there about 25 yards off the side of that trail, facing back that back trail with that bear laying there dead. He had run up that dang hill and turned around and come back, J-hooked back, and laid down there watching the back trail. If they'd have went on the first track, and somebody might have got killed. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of thought process you got to think about when you're doing them big game hunts. But it's fun. It's cool. I mean, it's exciting, and it's, you know, my whitetail hunting is my thing. That's what I really love, really enjoy, the public land stuff. I'm starting to spread out where I want to go to more states. But brown bear hunting and grizzly hunting is one of the – it's the upper food chain stuff. It's just you testing your abilities, your grit, and your calmness to stay calm to make them shots. I really love doing them hunts, and I recommend if anybody can do it or go to Alaska somehow or another, because it's them, you know, up is a way you shoot a brown bear for, because most people don't eat them. They say the meat's like eating a rotten fish, you know, they're just nasty, but it's like shooting coyotes or whatever they're, because if you don't control them upper predators, they'll eat so many moose calves or so many moose or so many baby bears or so many caribou calves or caribou, you know, you'll have a population switch, you know, one side will get overpopulated. So controlling them numbers helps, you know, helps people with the caribou herds and the moose herds. So you got to be a natural balance. So, you know, that's why I like enjoying them, you know, in them hunts where I don't bring that meat back, because you're actually helping other animals, you know, that's part of the predator control. And, you know, some people don't see that, but, you know, until you do that, you know, you'll learn that.
Yeah. Now I'm going to remember this story when I'm sleeping in my tent the first night there.
When I'm in them tents, you know, we sleep in them tents. And I told a guy, you know, I told every one of them guys that, listen, I go to sleep, that's the only way I'm waking up is when that brown bear puts them feet on my chest, you know. So, so we sleep with a rifle and a pistol. And I know y'all going to carry pistols, right?
Yeah.
Keep them things on you. And I can tell you another story that might freak you out more than that, is how good they can smell. Is if a bear wants to get you in a tent, he's going to circle that tent, and he can smell your breath and figure out where your head is, and will come through that tent where your head's at. So it's just so remember that.
I should not have brought this topic up with you, Michael.
I want you to be aware of all these things. That's how good they can smell. We watched them things hunt moose. This last place I camped at was camped on a little hill, and this brown bear were circling. They would come out way down a meadow and get downwind. Well, they could zigzag through that, them like cutover stuff, big old marshy, just willow flats, whatever. And you see them right up every now and then. But they would just circle back and forth smelling, trying to pick up a moose smell or caribou smell or whatever. And it was so neat how they knew how to circle away to get downwind and stuff. So they're sharp and real smart and pretty dangerous, you know. So
yeah,
we had one come into camp the last time, about an 8-foot brown bear, come walking right to us. We're standing out there on top of rocks with rifles. And it kept coming. We've done the hay bear and all that stuff. It kept coming. Guys said, step in the tent, get his pistol. So I stepped in there and hit a .45 and got it, because most of your Magnum rifles only hold 3 shells. So if you don't want to do a warning shot with one of them shells, because like I say, if they come after you at 40 mile an hour, you know, you've only got 1 or 2 shells. And most time them guys tell you to save one, just in case you want to take care of yourself before the bear takes care of you, you know. So but anyway, he got the pistol and shot from that bear at 40 yards from the tent. And that bear just stopped, like, what do y'all want? And just reared up, smelling, looking at us, sat down, and then just walked and walked at an angle by us without running anything, just walked by us, look at us every night, and then walked on by, never run or anything. Like, I don't care about y'all, but, you know.
Holy cow.
If they did care about us, he's like, I'll come over and wear you up if I wanted to, so you ain't going to tell me what to do. So anyway, so there's something to think about, and you kind of, you know, as bad as them stories sound, but you kind of need to be aware of the stuff, because anything could happen, so.
Yeah, I sleep like a rock. I sleep like a rock, too. So, like you said about the bear being on your chest, I won't even know that he's attacking, because I'll be done by that point.
I don't know. You know, some of them carry them electric fences, but most of them guys, I don't think they're more trouble than they were. So,
yeah. But no, I'm just going to
We just slept in the tent. We, you get up and be a big old track out there right in front of the tent, you know. So they come by during the night, which in the spring, on them spring hunts, the farther up, you know, like when I went out to Arctic hunt, it stayed daylight the whole time. You know, it never would get dark. You know, kind of dusk, but that, it was daylight the whole time. So you just slept however you wanted to sleep. So.
Yeah, that's how when we did that caribou hunt, it was like that too. It was light, you know, it was in the middle to the end of August, and it was like light most of the night. And I don't remember ever seeing darkness the whole time I was there because I was sleeping during that time. You know, even 11 o'clock at night, it was still light out. But I remember the one morning we woke up and I'm walking out there. I said to my buddy, I said, is that fresh, you know, bear shit laying there? And he's like, yep. I was like, okay, it's right here, you know, in between the tents, and just what it was, you know. So when we got our caribou meat, we put it downwind like 40 yards, and then we put a tarp on it, but left the one side open so it would flap in the wind. And we was told that that would kind of, you know, deter them from coming into it. I don't know, but that was I don't know. I slept as good as I could have at that point. So.
You just hope. That's what I always tell everybody is when you go on them hunts, you hope that you've lived a good enough life that, you know, something happens, you know, you can't really worry about it. Because if you worry about that stuff, you're worrying about the wrong thing. It's hard to enjoy it. So don't worry about it, you know, and enjoy it and be prepared. You know, keep yourself prepared. And the guys, you know, the guys going to be prepared. They're aware of a lot of stuff that you ain't. So just don't, you know, but since y'all going to be by yourself doing the DIY, y'all take care of each other.
Yeah, no, I'll have my 300 Win Mag, and then I have a 10 millimeter pistol as well. So I'll have everything there, and I won't take it off. I got a chest holster now because I used to always just carry my pistol in my backpack, but you realize you have your backpack off at the times when things, you know, it's just, I was like, I want something that's going to be on me at all times.
Yeah, you keep that on your chest. That guy that had the 45, them other guys carried them big old Smith & Wesson 500. This guy that I went last time, he had a 45, and I asked him, I said, well, why are you carrying a 45? And he said, it ain't going to matter anyway. He said, all I'm doing is going to wait till it gets up on top of him, and I'm going to stick it in his mouth, pull the trigger. So, all right. So he was kind of a rough, burly guy, and he had a knife right there and then that 45. And he said, I'm going to be close quarters, and I'm doing it. He said, I'll wait till he gets up on me, and I'm going to stick it in his mouth, start pulling that trigger. All right. as long as you let him get to you before he gets to me.
This has been a fun conversation, Michael. I appreciate you taking the time and talking to me. And, you know, I thought, you know, I knew we were going to talk about whitetails and didn't expect to get into Alaska stuff. But man, that's fun hearing those stories and talking about it. Cause it's fun to get out of your comfort zone sometimes in your home state and just go and see different stuff.
You learn. That's what I tell everybody. If you can afford it, you know, that's another thing. I'm just a plant worker. I've been working at a chemical plant for 26 years. You know, I've not really, my wife is not a keep up with the Joneses type of person. We don't spend much crazy money. So I've saved up enough money to go on some of these trips because they're right bucket list things, just things that I want to do. And I highly recommend if anybody that's listening or watching this, do something outside the box that you really want to do and try it and enjoy it because, you know, you've only got a certain amount of time you're going to be here. You know, make the best of it, do it, and get your family involved in it or your wife, whoever. And because, then, you know, we're getting enough pressure from the antis and stuff like that, some of the stuff we've already lost. So try to find something like that and enjoy it. Don't, you know, some people want to do it all DIY, but some of that stuff you can't. And then, but the adventure you'll have, it'd be well worth what money you can save up to do it because it's there's no other place in the world that you can do stuff like this. You know, we're blessed to be where we're at. So enjoy that and then do all you can, you know, do all the, you know, like I say, the public land and whitetails, but I enjoy, that's my biggest thing, but I love doing something outside the box, carry my wife with me or whatever, you know, go to Wyoming on public land, just anything like that. So try it and, you know, enjoy it and don't let anybody influence you a way you don't want to be influenced. So all the other negativity or whatever we got in some of this stuff, just, you know, do what you want to do, be comfortable with it. Don't let anybody else bother you about it.
Yeah, no, I love it. I think that's a perfect message to leave everyone with. And that's what I've tried to keep in the forefront of my mind as I've tried to trying to do as much as I can and see some amazing places, because it's changed my life, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I really believe it. Yeah, it's good talking to you, man. I really appreciate it, and I'm gonna get back with you later. I tried to call Bill the other day, and I didn't get a hold of him yet, but I'm gonna talk some more about that stuff we talked about the other day. So, but yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm real interested in that stuff y'all got. I'm real interested in that. So.
Yeah, no, awesome. And where can people find your book at? Where can they find that if they want to check it out?
You can find it on Amazon. It's on Amazon to look up Michael Perry, Secrets, Deer Hunting Secrets, Public Land Bucks, or was it Secrets to Taking Mature Bucks on Public Land. So look it up on Amazon. You can find it. If not, you can message me. I'll send you one. I've sent quite a few people if they want them signed. So that's the biggest place. There's a couple of stores in Alabama has them, but the biggest thing is just Amazon.
Okay. And then you also have Instagram and a YouTube channel as well. Where can people find that stuff?
So Instagram is Michael Perry 9. Then the YouTube is 18 Outdoors. I just started my own channel this year that me and my wife are doing, and I'm going to get my brother involved with it a little bit more. So, but it's basically us doing different things outdoors and, main, you know, the hunting and some tips and tactics and maybe some gear reviews and stuff we use. But just trying to be us. It's not going to be anything real fancy. You know, I can't be afford to buy all that fancy camera stuff, and I don't and trying to film a hunt is, you know, killing a big deer is one thing, trying to film yourself killing a big deer is another thing. So that's not going to be our priority. I'm going to try to get people involved in as much as I can, showing how it happens or whatever if it happens again. But you know, just but the other part, you know, it's just going to be us, you know, it's going to be, you know, the real deal. That's Southern folks.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you again for coming on. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be talking again here soon.
Yes, sir, brother. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.